From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So April 15th or 16th this year is behind us. The taxes are paid, and the pain of writing that check is starting to recede. And boom, here comes a new warning that we haven't seen anything yet. New estimates of the ocean of red ink facing the federal government in coming years put it much, much higher than politicians like to say. One estimate says we could sell everything we own, the country and every building on it, and still be $20 trillion short. So what will it be? Higher taxes, less government, or a third way? Up next on Point, the great debate over the red tide before us. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Kent Smetters, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He was Deputy Assistant Treasury Secretary in the first term of the current Bush administration. And he co-wrote a study with Jagadish Gokhale of the Cato Institute in the current issue of Financial Analysis Journal, arguing the country is facing deficits many times larger than the government cites today. Kent Smetters, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
Lay out the basics of what you found in your analysis, please.
Well, like you said at the top of the hour, the government holds two sets of books. In fact, the accounting done by the federal government would make Enron accounting look rather pristine, in the sense that the federal government has its official budget that focuses on annual cash flows, but doesn't take into account the future obligations and how those future obligations are growing over time. That's very inconsistent relative to the private sector. I once testified before Congress that if anybody in the private sector tried to ignore how future health care spending for the retirees or future pension obligations were increasing over time, they have them on the books, they would go to jail. And it's actually true.
So when the president stepped up a couple of months back when he delivered his budget and said, "The budget I am presenting achieves balance by 2012, is that a lie?
It's an accuracy under the current budget methodology that's highly flawed. And so, yes, it is true under the current budget methodology, using very heroic assumptions about, even within the current budget methodology, about things dealing with the alternative minimum tax, the spending in the war, things like that, then yes, his projection does say balanced by 2012. I will say, however, these types of projections of budget balance within 4 or 5 years have been made over and over and over. We've never achieved it. And so I'm skeptical even under the current flawed budget framework that we'll actually have budget balance by 2012. However, under an inclusive budget framework that takes into account the growing obligations in Social Security, Medicare in particular, we're not even close to budget balance. Instead of having depending where the numbers come in at the end of the year, $200-300 billion deficit, our true deficit, if estimated accurately, would be in the trillions of dollars. Literally, just the deficit alone, the annual change in our debt obligations, would be over $2 trillion.
David Broder at the Washington Post calls the idea that we're going to really be balanced in 2012 chicanery. And yet, when we get into these bigger numbers, we know they're politically loaded. There are lots of ways of looking at them. We're going to hear those in this hour. But give us your rundown. I mean, I've got bullet points pulled out of your report here that are really head turning. The first one I mentioned at the top, but that you and Jagadish suggest that if the federal government confiscated all the land in the United States, along with all of its improvements, buildings, highways, plant equipment, other durable assets, and sold it all to foreign investors, the federal government would still fall more than $20 trillion short in present value of the monies required to satisfy its future budget. Our entire net worth is not up to our obligations?
Well, there's two things. One, it's even worse than that in many ways. You forgot to include homes, dishwashers, all consumer durables, cars, and so forth. That was actually part of the calculation as well. Obviously, this is just a way of trying to jab people on the side just to kind of wake them up. However, there is something that one asset that we have as a country that's much more valuable than our physical assets, and that's our human capital. The value of human capital in the United States, our worker productivity, is about three times the physical assets.
Well, that's terrific, and that produces value every year. But even on that front, you say that paying for promised benefits, if we really wanted to get on top of this, would require a 14.4% tax on all payroll income, a tax increase so large that it wouldn't be collectible, that those highly productive Americans would just take their work underground.
Yeah. In fact, it would require more than doubling the current Social Security and Medicare taxes that people already see on their pay stub. But it's even worse than that because they only see half the tax. The other half falls on their employer, so it would require doubling on their employer as well. And that, in turn, would get passed to workers in the form of lower wages. And you're right, it's completely non-sustainable. We've seen other countries like Brazil, which tried to levy high taxes. All that happened is that a lot of the workers simply went into what we call the informal sector. And so Brazil actually collects even less revenue because of the higher taxes.
I've got to ask you, Kent Smithers, you worked with in the first Bush term, including working on President Bush's effort to privatize or reform Social Security. Is this economists can roll out really dire numbers, and we've seen that. Is this a roundabout way of promoting the president's plan for privatizing Social Security? As an economist, do you believe that must be done, that the federal government has to walk away from its promises here?
No, in fact, it's quite different than that. This study really is politically independent. It's just an accounting exercise. It doesn't say whether we should reduce the growth rate of benefits over time, or which would be kind of the Republican approach, or increase taxes over time, which would be more the Democrat approach. It really is agnostic in that sense. It simply says if we continue under current law, what are the implications? And the implications are that we just don't have enough money to available to afford these programs. So again, a Republican could walk away of this exercise and say, hey, let's reduce benefits, or at least the growth rate of benefits over time. A Democrat could walk away and say, hey, we need higher revenue. So it's really politically independent. I will also say that I'm actually the optimist. Me and my co-author are actually the optimist on this issue.
Wow.
The Social Security.
Now we're scared. This is the optimistic scenario.
This is the optimistic scenario. The Social Security Medicare trustees a couple of years ago adopted this method, the same methodology. The numbers are buried in the report, but their numbers are even worse than ours. They actually find, whereas Jagdish Gokhale and I say that the present value of the shortfalls is roughly about $65 trillion, they actually find it in the Social Security and Medicare programs over $15 trillion, higher than that, around $80 trillion. And the reason why is that they use different assumptions. They use what's called trustees' assumptions. Mm-hmm. We use the president's budget assumptions when we project forward.
But so both ways, we're talking about scores of trillions of dollars here, unaccounted for. There are different views of how we ought to be looking at. Some Democrats now saying all this talk is deficit mania and we should get a grip on it. Others really worried about it. Kent Smithers, please stand by for a moment. I've got with us from Washington Jim Cooper. He's a Democratic congressman from Tennessee's 5th District, that's Nashville and its surrounding area. It's his 9th term in Congress. He's been around. He's on the House Budget Committee. Representative Cooper, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. You've been ringing warning bells on this pretty loud and for a while now. Give us your view of where we're headed on the ocean of red.
Well, Tom, I think it's the most important domestic policy issue we face because the average American today listening to this broadcast, their share of the national debt is roughly $29,000 if you believe simplistic government bookkeeping, which Kent just described as completely illegal in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
If you use real numbers, your individual share isn't $29,000. It's more like $170,000 and growing fast. And just as we as individuals have credit cards in our pocket and we attempted to charge too much on those cards and we leave unpaid balances, America has done that. And the situation is getting so grave right now that completely outside of politics, there's a top credit rating agency in New York called Standard & Poor's.
Sure.
They've already projected that the U.S. Treasury bond will lose its AAA rating in just 4 or 5 years. And that would put us at the same credit level as Greece and Estonia. I think most Americans don't want us to live in Greece or Estonia. They think America is better than that. We are better than that, but we need to be tougher in our fiscal policies in order to retain our top credit rating.
What does this mean to you then? Double the taxes? Cut the the promises to the American people in half? You're a blue dog conservative Democrat on this. What do you think should be done?
Well, first, we have to act quickly. The longer we wait, the worse the problem will be. Kent Smetters just mentioned that the problem is getting worse at the rate of trillions of dollars a year. I've calculated it getting worse at the rate of about $350 million an hour or $95,000 a second. So every moment we waste is adding to the problem. Second, I don't favor increased taxes. We should look first at cutting spending. And I think we're going to end up at some sort of third-way solution because the simplistic solutions of the past simply won't work. It took us a decade or more to climb out of the Reagan deficits. It's going to take decades to climb out of these problems if we have the national will to do it. And I'm increasingly worried that we're borrowing so much money from China and other foreign nations that we may lack the national will to solve these problems. And that would be a true American tragedy.
Cut spending. Does that mean cut Social Security, cut Medicare?
It means looking at all of our programs, including our entitlement programs, because those are growing the fastest. And a lot of that money is well spent, but a lot of money is wasted. In Tennessee, for example, my state, Tennesseans are on more medications than the people of any other state. And if that were making us healthier, that would be one thing. But we're actually almost bankrupting ourselves in Tennessee to do what? In order to poison ourselves by taking more medicines than any doctor can ever possibly figure out or reconcile.
We've been joined from Washington by Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee's 5th District, Blue Dog Democrat. He's been loud on this for a long time, says it's crunch time now. Kent Smetters is with us. He was with the Treasury Department in the first Bush term. He's a professor at Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and out with a new report saying that the actual deficits we're facing are many times larger than the government says. We're joined now as well from Washington by Jared Bernstein. He's senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, former deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor, author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. He's got a different view on all the talk about deficits. Jared Bernstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
So you hosted a big hoedown of Democrats at the Economic Policy Institute this month, where the theme was, let's settle down on all this deficit mania, as economist Joseph Stiglitz has called it, the Nobel Prize winner. What's your view of what's going on here, Jared?
Well, my view is similar to that of Stiglitz, as he presented it at our forum, which is that most of what you've heard so far from Jim and Kent has at least a grain, and in many cases a lot more than a grain of truth. I'm not at all disagreeing with them that there's lots of red ink out there. But I think that it's not very productive to do a couple of things. First of all, I think Kent, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kent, is using what economists call an infinite horizon model to figure out the extent of our indebtedness. And I don't think that's particularly useful. We can get into the technicalities of why. But to put it, I think, fairly plainly, I think the goal of both Kent and Jim here, and it's a venerable goal, is to get people paying attention. And I'm afraid that none of the numbers that they cite and use demonstrably are doing so. I mean, when people hear that debt is accumulating at $95,000 a second, or that we could sell everything in our country, including our dishwashers and our, you know, dogs and cats, I just think that it kind of goes over people's head and it doesn't really reach them.
Well, I don't know. It gets my attention. You talk about junk bond status and the U.S. Credit rating being on the same level as Greece and Estonia.
It may get your attention, but I'm saying demonstrably thus far in the debate, and we could have had exactly the same discussion a few years ago, although I grant you that things have gotten redder, and nothing's changed. In fact, if anything, the situation has gotten worse. So I think if your goal is to get people focused on the problem and do something about it, you have to operate differently. And one of the ways in which, and I think you and Jim were getting into it a little bit in your last discussion, one of the ways in which you have to operate differently is to understand how people feel about the the things that we're talking about here. We're talking about pension security, Social Security. Yep. We're talking about health care. Yep. We're talking about Medicare. Jim, you know, you correctly said, so, you know, what do you want to do? You want to cut it or you want to fund it? In fact, mm-hmm. both Kent and Jim have been very clear on this. I mean, it's not rocket science. You raise the money or you don't, and then you cut spending. So, you know, Jim talked about cutting waste in the medical system. That's absolutely critically important. But, you know, it isn't exactly sitting out there like a softball down the middle. And so somebody's ox is going to get gored. And thus far, politicians, unlike present company, have been unwilling to actually make some of the hard calls regarding going up against the medical industrial complex,
yep.
which is over-medicating. I grant Jim's point. And being very straight about what it's going to take. For example, let me give you one. Let me just throw one number out here that I think really should focus this debate. We talked about the Social Security Trust Fund, the trustees' estimate that came out the other day.
Yep.
They told us that through 2081, and by the way, I think if you want to make a 75-year projection, you know, it's a little dubious, but go ahead. But an infinite projection, I think that's a distraction. I mean, we
okay, GDP's, so 2081, okay, what?
2081, the shortfall in Social Security is 0.7% of GDP. The cost of extending the tax cuts for the top 1% of taxpayers is 0.6% of GDP. In other words, we could pay for the shortfall in the Social Security Trust Fund by allowing the Bush tax cuts, not all of them, because to do all of them would pay for it about three times over, but allowing the Bush tax cuts for the top 1% to sunset. So I think that that gives you a very concrete thing to think about.
So there's a way at the margins like Jim, to deal with it, you're saying, that wouldn't necessarily...
Politicians like Jim could deal with this tomorrow. In fact, Jim proposes to do exactly that. Allow that part to sunset, and you begin to chip away at one dimension of the problem, which happens to be one of the smaller dimensions of the problem.
Let me put it to Congressman Cooper, if I may. Jared Bernstein. Congressman, a couple of things. First of all, Jared's saying, here's one example on a program as big as Social Security where a tweak, which sounds manageable on taxes for wealthier Americans, could solve the problem. At the same time, in the 90s, we saw the Democrats go really hard with Rubenomics and balanced budget fervor on getting a balanced budget. Where do you stand in this, Congressman Cooper? Do you think that the Democrats should pull the country back to a balanced budget with all the pain that may entail, or Joseph Stiglitz saying, hey, let's not get deficit mania here. There may be things we should be investing in. Can we fix this with palatable tweaks, as Jared Bernstein suggests here?
Well, Tom, I think the proudest legacy of the Clinton administration was the fact that it balanced the budget, at least in nominal terms, for 3 years. That hadn't been done since the 1920s. Mm. Almost every year in America, we've run deficits of some size. So I think it's important that you have deficits as a goal. I'm not saying you have to have strict numerical balance every year, but you need to live within your means. And I think most Americans understand that because you just can't borrow money forever without facing dire consequences. Social Security is a fixable problem if we have the political will. It's got fewer variables in it than Medicare does, which is in 10 times worse shape than Social Security. But we need to start addressing both entitlement programs and others so that the problems don't become even larger than they are today.
Ken Smithers, I want to try and get a handle on this so that listeners don't get lost in the numbers. We're told there's a crisis, then we're told we can fix it. It's not going to be that painful. On Medicare, and that's huge, much bigger than Social Security, as Congressman Cooper points out. Your report suggests, just to give us a sense of scale here, that if we completely eliminated all military spending in this country, and we know how much we spend on it, eliminate all of that forever, that would only cover about a half of the unfunded liabilities of Medicare. That doesn't sound like something that we can address by tweaking at the edges.
Right, and I basically agree with Jared and Jim that Social Security is the much easier problem for two reasons. One, numerically, it's a smaller problem. Also, it's a dollar benefit. So you can easily scale that, presumably in a progressive way, cut the growth rate, not the real value of benefits, simply how they're growing over time, especially to richer people. Medicare is a much bigger problem, both numerically and the fact that it's an in-kind benefit. It's hard to think about paying for half an open-heart surgery. And so it's really, I would call Medicare a crisis. I would not use the crisis language for Social Security because then how do we describe Medicare? However, having said that, the Bush administration rarely referred to Social Security as a crisis. It was Bill Clinton who first termed the Social Security problem a crisis. And it's, I think, inappropriate. I would call it a big problem. I would call it Medicare problem.
Doesn't it go all the way really back to the Reagan administration? We had blue ribbon commissions wading into this thing. It had a crisis tone about it even then.
Yeah, well, back in 1983, we really did have a crisis on Social Security. The trust fund was literally a few months from running out of money. And as a result of that, we would have had to automatically cut or delay benefit payments. So that was a crisis, and the 1983 reforms did deal with that somewhat. Now, part of the problem with the 1983 reforms, and maybe where Jared and I would differ, is that I don't believe that additions to the Social Security Trust Fund really add to public saving. The reason why is this fraudulent budget that we have that basically adds the Social Security surpluses right back into the unified budget.
Into the general budget that we spend every year.
Yes, and as a result, to the extent that we really try to, we think about this numeric target of a zero deficit as being a good target, or whatever the target is, $100 billion, $200 billion, whatever. To the extent that we focus on a numeric target, that implies that we, in effect, spend the Social Security Trust Fund in the back door, either through tax reductions or in the form of higher costs elsewhere in the budget.
Which leaves that deficit sitting out there. Jared Bernstein, I want to come to you in a minute. You've talked about Congressman Cooper says the proudest achievement of the Clinton years was the balanced budget. You've decried a zombie-like allegiance to balancing the budget, and I want to understand what you mean by that. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us first. Jeff's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was glad to hear talk of the 1% who are benefiting quite well by our economy presently.
And, the top 1%, that is. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the idea of tweaking the
Bush tax cuts there?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fine, but I feel like the problem is larger than that. I wonder if any of your panelists know, in the preceding administrations, the Clinton and Bush 1 and the Reagan, I mean, how long has it been that this 1% has been having its taxes trimmed and becoming more prosperous as a result?
Congressman Cooper, pick that up with us. And I want to try and keep this open to our – I mean, there's so many numbers here. I don't want to lose track of what's really going on. First, how much of the problem could be addressed by having the really affluent and rich in this country pitch in a little more? How much more deep than that does it need to go? Is this something that's going to have to bite everyone to fix?
Well, a significant portion of the problem could be solved by, and that would be returning people to the Clinton level of taxation, which, as you remember, was the most prosperous period in all of American history. It was the longest sustained recovery that our nation has ever had. Mm. So if we were able to do that at Clinton tax levels then, many Democrats think, well, perhaps we should be able to do it again. But the
Congressman Cooper is cutting out on us, and I'm sorry to hear that. Kent Smithers, what's your assessment on that front? Can we do this by sneaking back some of those Bush tax cuts for the affluent, or is it going to be a much more widely felt impact?
Yeah, the Bush tax cuts, it's not going to even come close to solving the entire Social Security Medicare problem. Again, the Medicare problem is much, much more significant. And there's multiple ways of cutting the tax cuts. On one hand, you know, Clinton increased taxes, Bush reduced them. Yes, it is true that depending on how you slice it, richer taxpayers who do pay, but, you know, the top 10% of taxpayers pay over 60% of all taxes in the United States. So there was this argument that they're also creating jobs, they're the entrepreneurs. We have to think about encouraging them to do that. Do I think the Bush tax cuts were the smartest way to go? No, I don't. But at the same time, one thing that's very important is that the effective tax rate on capital income in the United States is actually higher than in European nations, which have much higher labor taxes. That's simply not sustainable as we become more internationalized. And I think we do need a fundamental tax reform that can be done in a very progressive way, that through either full expensive capital that helps reduce those taxes. And one just last point about accounting. I mean, one of the liberal solutions is to say, okay, well, let's just increase the earnings cap on Social Security. Right now, people pay up to a certain dollar limit on
right. So keep chipping in past 90 something, whatever it is now, up into the 100,000.
Yeah, exactly. Plus. Mm-hmm. So let's increase that over time. Mm-hmm. The problem with the 75-year accounting that Jared talked about is the reason why this leads to lots of budget gimmicks, is that this type of solution allows you to collect money inside that window, but all the increase in benefits fall outside that window. And so it makes it look like that helps solve some of the problem, where in reality, in present value, the impact is very small. And this is the reason why we have a Social Security discussion today. In 1983, they supposedly solved the 75-year problem. Well, the problem is that window moves over 20-some years, and now that window moves brings in 20 more years of deficit years in the out years, and now we're back to having a 75-year problem.
And that hole sits right there. Consumers, stand by for a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Congressman Cooper, I'm sorry we lost you there, and I know we've just
got
you.
I think I'm back now.
Well, yes, you're back loud and clear, and I'm glad we've got you. Let me ask you an essential question here. We'll go to Jared Bernstein with this, too, but we're going to lose you in a couple of minutes. Democrats kind of made their mark in the 90s under Clinton with Reaganomics, going for this balanced budget. Now, the Republicans have come back in. Deficits have gotten huge again. You know that the Democrats are now divided on this, whether they should campaign back toward a balanced budget or say, wait a minute, there are investments we need to make in this country that are going to require deficits. Let's learn how to live with that in a sensible way. How do you look at that debate? I guess we know where you stand in it, but how do you analyze the implications of which way the Democrats turn now that they're back in the majority in Congress?
Well, Tom, we're more unified than you might think. We're all for the PAYGO principle, which even Alan Greenspan said was the single most important fiscal reform that either party could undertake.
That is, pay PAYGO as you go, have the income to pay for what you're spending.
So if you need a new investment...
Oh, we've had trouble with that line today. Are you there, Congressman?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I've got you.
Okay. We have to pay for it, and that's a fundamental principle. It worked well from 1990 to 2002, but the Republicans allowed it to expire. So we've already put it back in place in the new Congress under the Democratic majorities, and I think you're going to see strict enforcement of PAYGO as we go forward.
Is that a winning strategy for the Democrats, or does that get you tossed right back out because, you know, you're going to be seen as stern taskmasters not delivering what people want?
Well, I think it is a winning strategy because people understand fiscal responsibility. They know you got to pay for stuff. Money doesn't grow on trees. There is no free lunch. So I think you have to give voters credit for their intelligence. They know what's going on, sometimes better than Washington politicians do. So I think it will be a tough love strategy that will work.
And what do you say to the Stiglitz argument, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, that sometimes you've got to invest in things you need? He wouldn't go for the war, but he's saying on the education front, infrastructure, we need this for the country to prosper and pay off its debts in future years.
Well, Stiglitz is a brilliant economist, and we do favor, as Democrats, investments in our infrastructure and in our human capital. That will be done, but we will be responsible and we will pay for them. We've been criticized as tax and spend, but that's better than borrow and spend, Republicans. So the key thing, though, is not to have a partisan fight about it. It's to appeal to the common sense middle of the country and get our priorities paid for so that we leave our kids a better country than the one that we came to. So it's very important that we strengthen the country, not weaken it.
Congressman Cooper, I know we've got to let you go. I really appreciate your being with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
George is calling from New Rochelle, New York. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just curious why we haven't tried to innovate some of the areas that out of the situation. Not to say it's a total solution, but it sort of would put some dents in this. People who receive multiple government checks, like Bush or Colin Powell, that had several positions in the government and received pensions from each one of those. I mean, we have dozens of people who have to pay for their check just to make up those areas, and you multiply that times how many employees in the government, and you can see a dent there. How about the illegals who haven't paid taxes for 10, 20 years, want a green card or a citizenship? Maybe say, look, How many years haven't you paid? Pay that back plus penalties, things like that, and then maybe even legalize marijuana and put a tax on it, or something. You know, there's lots of alternatives that could be to get more revenue and keep.
Right. So let's think out of the box and maybe solve the crisis that way. Jared Bernstein, how about it? Can we look at people? Politicians always talk about going after waste. George looks at the same thing, says, let's get some more revenues from illegal immigrants working here, though a lot of them pitch in already, but let's get more. Let's look, I don't know, tax dope. I mean, can we do this with cleaning up waste and squeezing at the margins?
Let me say a couple of things that are triggered by George's comments. I mean, first of all, none of these will get to the very big ticket items we're talking about, which I think we've largely agreed on has to do with health care. And by the way, let me introduce, I think, a really important dimension to this. When we talk about the health care problem we face, it is not a public sector Medicare problem. It is a private sector problem as well, and has to do with inefficiencies and waste in our health care system. We spend about twice as much as a share of our economy on healthcare than other advanced economies, and our outcomes are no better.
I mean, it's so expensive for Medicare because commercial healthcare is so expensive.
Right. If you solved the Medicare problem and didn't do anything about health costs in the private sector, you'd be back where you started. Now, George's point on immigrants, I think, is probably got that wrong in the sense that, Tom, you mentioned illegal immigrants pay payroll taxes. And those payroll taxes are actually a subsidy to the Social Security system. They're paying that into the system, but they're not drawing it out as benefits later. Now, if those folks were became legal and paid other taxes, you know, perhaps there'd be some balance there. But I don't think that the kinds of pretty small bore ideas that he was supporting would solve the large problems we're talking about. But, you know, that doesn't mean they're bad ideas. I think, in fact, that's the right way to think about this rather than to say, you know, we have to sell the country. It's probably makes more sense to think about relatively incremental changes that we can take, with the exception of healthcare. There, we can't think incrementally. There, we need big changes.
Okay, so selling the country, that's the sort of let's get our attention thing that Kent Smithers puts forward. But what about Congressman Cooper? He had to run, but he's saying, look, Democrats should go back to the pay-as-you-go, pay-go formula that worked well for them in the 90s. He also says, despite the conference you guys have held, he says, this party's united behind this. This is where we're going. Yeah. What do you say?
Well, look, the party is united behind pay-go, and they should be, because the idea behind pay-as-you-go, and I wish Jim were still here to talk about this, I think he would agree, is that for Democrats, this is largely a defensive tactic. This says to Republicans, you just can't keep passing tax cuts. I suspect Kent would agree with this as well, without paying for them. And as long as you have a pay-go in the system, you can't just blithely go forward and say, okay, here's another $50 billion on tax cuts, here's another $100 billion, and just don't worry about the kids, will take care of it. So, you know, that's been actually pretty effective. But let me tell you a tiny little story, if I can take a few seconds, about PAYGO. A couple of weeks ago, I was testifying before the Senate on a minimum wage increase. This was a little bitty old increase in the minimum wage, which has been stuck at $5.15 for 10 years to go up to $7.25 by 2009. Yep. This affects about 5 million people. It's a good idea, but it's not a huge policy. Well, the Senate Finance Committee came up with $8 billion worth of tax cuts that they argued were needed to offset the cost of businesses of raising the minimum wage. Now, I argued against that. I don't think businesses need an offset, much like we didn't need to raise their taxes when the minimum wage was falling in value. But somehow these guys combed through the tax code and pretty quickly came up with $8 billion to offset this tax cut. My point here is that when Congress wants to spend money, you know, they can find ways to do it. So I think it's I think that what needs to be injected into this discussion is a matter of priorities. I mean, are we or are we not spending $1 trillion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? By the way, that's a Stiglitz estimate. That is clearly, demonstrably, a national priority. Now, it's not one that many, I suspect, of our listeners or many citizens even share at this point. But we can pay for the things that we believe to be critically important to our future. To argue that we can't is to take the budget debate in a direction of priorities that you are setting because of your personal views and preferences. And I don't think that's the right way forward.
Let's take a call from Davenport, Iowa. Robert, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Tom.
Hi, Robert.
I think I can make this real quick. When Bush came in, as I remember, there was a surplus, and I watched American Idol last night, and they were showing how people in America are hurting. I'm sure due to a lot of the cuts that were made, cut to the bone to balance the budget. And then as soon as they got in, they acted like some foxes in their hen house. They went in and took all that money and gave themselves a big tax cut. I'm just saying, I don't see, I think we should learn that we shouldn't be worried about balancing the budget if somebody could come in and 8 years from now after the Democrats balance it and then be able to just come in and steal everything. Because that was wrong.
Robert, we've got it. Kent Smithers, I think that's a common way of seeing what happened here. We were told, hooray, we've balanced the budget, we've got a surplus. Then suddenly we turn around and we're told, hey, it's gone, and we don't know when it's coming back.
There's several issues here. First of all, the Clinton surplus was largely driven, especially in the out years, partly in essence because there was a surprise revenue that we now know in hindsight was due to things like stock options and others. It was part of the bubble in many ways.
The stock market internet bubble of the late 90s, you're saying.
Right. And so that it was not sustainable. At the same time, there's no question discretionary spending relative to either however you measure it, GDP, even inflation, did this decrease under Clinton, and it's increased under Bush. And so that's the great irony here is that Clinton in many ways was more fiscally conservative in that sense. You know, in terms of taxes, I agree in the sense that if I were to do the Bush tax cuts, I would have done them radically different. And in particular, I would have maintained a lot of the progressivity, really whacked away at the effective tax rate on capital income. I don't believe our effective tax rate and capital income in the United States is simply sustainable for us to be competitive going forward.
But let me ask you something that goes to our caller Robert's point. He says, look, we did this hard work. We took the hits. We got it balanced. Yes, we had help from a bubble, but we did that. We decreased the discretionary spending, as you say. Then as soon as we got a little oxygen in the system, the next administration, turns out to be George Bush's, comes in, gobbles that all up and spends even more. So do we have the political will in this country to get on top of this deficit crisis, as you describe it, or not? And if we don't, are we headed toward that kind of national meltdown debacle that your numbers seem to suggest, or do the countries just ride these things out somehow?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because it's getting us back to what's really important here. I mean, we can all debate on the Bush tax cuts all we want, but that's not the real issue here. The real issue is, again, the increases in entitlement spending, Social Security and Medicare. Even if we reverse these tax cuts, it's not 100% clear how much revenue they're going to bring in because of some of the feedbacks effect on the economy and so forth. But the real issue is that we have to get away from thinking about just year-by-year deficits and really thinking about the big picture going forward. And that is we face very, very significant entitlement problems. And that is if we increase taxes in the most broad-based sense
to pay for those entitlements by doubling
The employer and employee payroll tax that we currently have, and that's a tax with no deductions. It has a, and I'm talking about a new tax with no ceiling at all.
Yep.
That would simply collapse the economy. There's just simply not enough tax revenue out there to solve this problem. We have to have a debate on how to control the growth rate of spending, and I think the grand political compromise is as follows. And that is Republicans unquestionably lied through their teeth about the carve-out accounts that have been proposed in the last couple of years. Not so much the White House, but many of its promoters like Newt Gingrich, Jack Kemp, Peter Farrar, talking about some great free lunch from these carve-out accounts that would have put some of your money into your own personal account.
You mean the privatizing Social Security?
Well, privatizing means...
Is that what you mean by carve-out?
Privatizing Social Security means that you oppose this reform. The promoters refer to it as personal accounts.
But that's what you're talking about, is the
personal...
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about, yes. And there's no question that many of the promoters have simply... misrepresented the potential.
So where's the grand compromise?
But the grand compromise is the Republicans who support that type of reform need to come clean and say there's no free lunch here. There's no easy solution here. We really have to still think about controlling benefits or increasing taxes. And the Democrats on the other side, they need to come and actually say, yes, there is a long-term problem. There's not too many Jim Coopers out there. When Congressman Wexler a few years ago proposed a plan, and his plan was very much a liberal Democrat plan to simply increase payroll taxes to solve the Social Security problem, he was really tongue-whipped by then Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi for even acknowledging that there was a problem.
Okay, hold the thought there. I'm sure Jared Bernstein wants to come in. Jared,
right.
Number one, is there a long-term problem, really? What suggested here? Are you prepared to say that?
Not in terms of Social Security.
The whole picture. Don't break it into pieces. Americans want to know, are we headed into a crisis that's going to mean diminished lifestyle, sort of hunkered down and payback decades?
Look, I mean, no is the answer to the last part of your question. Yes is the answer to crisis in terms of medical spending that is going to outpace GDP per capita in a way that's unsustainable. No in terms of Social Security. And frankly, I think if you don't break it down that way, you're really not being very helpful in terms of trying to figure out how we solve this problem. Mm. I think, you know, much of what Ken just said at the latter part of his answer, I would disagree with. Again, I take you back to the fact that you don't need to go to payroll taxes, which is a pretty regressive tax, when you can pay for the 75-year shortfall in Social Security by just allowing the Bush tax cuts on the top 1%. Folks, by the way, and we sort of blew by this comment by Robert that he said, you know, a lot of people are struggling out there. Mm-hmm. Well, the share of income going to the top 1% is about 22% right now. It's the highest it's been since 1929, and that's pre-tax. That's before tax.
Yep.
So you exacerbate that inequality when you cut taxes up there. So why go after the payroll tax when you could fix the 75-year shortfall, which is as long as a window as I think, and by the way, as Social Security actuaries think, is necessary.
We take your point, but we don't want to leave Medicare out of this because we haven't fixed health care, and it's got to be paid.
It's not Medicare. It's health care. It's not. You fix Medicare, you still have the problem. Now, do you want to talk about...
But Medicare is what we pay for as citizens collectively. So that's what goes to our fiscal bottom line.
Right, but what I'm saying is that if the health care... You could fix the Medicare problem. By the way, the shortfall in Medicare comes to about the same cost over a 75-year window as all of the Bush tax cuts. If all of the Bush tax cuts were rescinded, were sunsetted as planned in law, that would return about $14 trillion. The shortfall in the Medicare Hospital Trust Fund is about $12 trillion. So, you know, Medicare is actually manageable over the 75-year window. Health care is not.
I hear Kent Smith. We're not going to solve that, but we hear the disagreement on that. But here's the thing, Jared. Is it then out of bounds for a good Democrat, in your view, to say we're headed toward a crisis? Should they be saying something else? Is that soft selling the problem we're facing?
I think they should be saying that. I think they should be saying that because that ought to pave, you know, that's the way to pave the way towards health care reform. But you shouldn't say that unless you have a solution. And it ought to be a solution that speaks to people, you know, kind of like Robert, who seemed to me to be saying, it looks like all the benefits of this economy are accruing to the top, and, you know, and they get the surplus, too.
We did the work, and then off it went.
They got the surplus, too. So, I will very much be listening for candidates who say, we have an economic crisis here in the health care system, and here's how we're going to solve it.
Will stopping the war solve the problem, or is that marginal at this point? Jared, first you.
Stopping the war will absolutely help because it will free up many hundreds of billions of dollars.
So, but we're talking trillions, scores of trillions here.
Right, and we're probably talking about, according to Stiglitz, the cost of the war value is $1 to $2 trillion. So we're talking about trillions as well. But, you know, we're talking about a couple of trillion versus a system that is in debt to the many tens of trillions. So stopping the war will help for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is at this point, I think we're wasting national treasure, not to mention lives. Mm. So stopping the war will absolutely help, but we still need health care reform.
Kent Smithers, the economist sitting there at Wharton, do you see this grand compromise coming together or still kind of, you know, fancy talk and push it under the rug as a country?
No, I don't. In fact, I see many of the rhetoric just the opposite. If you go onto the campaign websites of Obama, Hillary, and others, you don't see any discussion at all about the long-term problems facing the country. And so we really, the Republicans need to come clean about some of the solutions, what they do and do not do. Democrats need to come clean about what the situation it really is.
We've got half a minute. When is this going to actually start to really pinch people? I see all kinds of years out there, but how soon? Is it all still decades away, or is this around the corner in some respect?
No. In fact, financial markets react to this rather quickly. S&P is about to, in a few years,
will
downgrade.
It just hit a record. What are you talking about?
Yeah. No. But I'm talking about the fixed income markets, the bond markets.
Right.
The fact of the matter is I'm surprised S&P is waiting this long.
So when does it bite? When do you think it may bite in a way that people will broadly feel?
You know, it's hard to say when we hit an Argentina situation because those things tend to snap very quickly. But I would say just in literally 5-10 years, we could feel the huge impact of the prescription drug bill that we haven't even talked about that's going to be very costly.
And with that, we're out of time. Let's pray we never hit that Argentina mark. Let's act before Kent Smithers at the Wharton School, Jared Bernstein at the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Really appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.